Have you ever wondered how Charlotte became a banking city or the story behind the water towers around town? Vote for one of those questions and WFAE will answer it in an upcoming episode of the FAQ City Podcast. Find the FAQ City Podcast and cast your vote now by going to wfae.org/FAQ City. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Today marks the 50th anniversary of the assassination of civil rights leader Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. When the news broke of his murder on a balcony at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee on April the 4th, 1968, it shook the nation.
Good evening. Dr. Martin Luther King, the apostle of nonviolence in the civil rights movement, has been shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee. Dr. King was standing on the balcony of a second-floor hotel room tonight when, according to a companion, a shot was fired from across the street. In the friend's words, the bullet exploded in his face. Mayor Henry Loeb has reinstated the dusk-to-dawn curfew he imposed on the city last week when a march led by Dr. King erupted in violence. And police report that the murder has touched off sporadic acts of violence in a Negro section of the city.
Walter Cronkite reporting the breaking news of King's death on CBS television. Riots would break out across the country as anger over his murder spread, and his funeral in Atlanta was covered on live network television as though Dr. King had been a head of state. As the ashes from the violence cooled, and with the benefit of time, King has come to be revered, remember, as one of this nation's great leaders. But at the time of his death, this larger-than-life figure had been tarnished. His negative comments about America's participation in the ongoing war in Vietnam and his Poor People's Campaign led even some longtime supporters to distance themselves. And a Gallup poll 2 years before his death found widespread disapproval of King. Social policy expert Warnie Reed says that since his death, King has been whitewashed and would be very disappointed with America's progress on poverty. So on this 50th anniversary of Dr. King's death, we invited Dr. Reed to talk about the trajectory of King's work at the time of his death and the legacy he left behind. He is director of Virginia Tech's Race and Social Policy Center, where he joins us this hour. Dr. Reed, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Also with us is J. Cameron Carter, Associate Professor of Theology and of English and African American Studies at the Duke Divinity School and author of Race, A Theological Account. Thank you for being with us as well.
Thank you for having me.
And you can join our conversation on email at charlottetalks at wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at charlottetalks. Dr. Reed, let me start with you. You met Dr. King during the Montgomery bus boycott. You were part of the 1963 March on Washington, and you say that what people know about King today was not the King you knew. Who was the man you knew, and how do you think he is viewed today?
As you indicated, earlier, Martin Luther King had a high disapproval rating in this country in 1966, 2 years before he was assassinated. And that was because people disagreed with many of the things he did and did not think highly of him. And the head of the FBI was going around talking about King as the most dangerous man in America and so on. But since his death, all of a sudden, he's now this this big hero, and he was a hero then. But what I mean is people remember him in as heroic, but they don't remember his heroism. Mm. That is, they don't remember what he did. They remember things like, well, Martin Luther King was a man of peace. He went around trying to bring peace between the races, and Martin Luther King was nonviolent, and he had a dream. These kinds of things caused a lot of people to misunderstand what Martin Luther King did. First, the "I have a dream" was those ad lib ending to his speech at the March on Washington. But I would wish people would read the first part of the speech. That better characterizes what Martin Luther King was about. For example, he said, "If you think we are here just to blow off steam, you will have a rude awakening." Mm, mm. And that was the case because there were many more activities, many more protests, many more demonstrations as pushes were made for the Civil Rights Bill and also then for the Voting Rights Act. So King was an activist, not a dreamer. Martin Luther King went to jail 30 times. You have to be doing something, whether or not you're guilty of some real law, to be arrested that many times. And so Martin Luther King was an activist. And for example, when he was assassinated, he was leading the Poor People's Campaign, which was going to be the largest, I think, one of the most impactful things he'd ever done. He had said that if necessary, we would close down Washington, D.C. We're going to have nonviolence, but we're going to have a massive demonstration until the federal government begins to implement plans to reduce poverty. So people don't remember these kinds of things. They remember him as, I guess, this nice, pious person who promoted peace.
I suppose it's because
and I can go further.
We have an hour. I suppose that it's because it's been 50 years, but it's not just you who are saying that his legacy and the characterization of Dr. King as a peacemaker kind of diminishes who he is. His daughter Bernice also says that her father has been whitewashed and mischaracterized over time. And that children today are taught a sanitized version of King's activism, contributing, she says, to a deliberately distorted view of him as more of a pacifist and less of a radical than he actually was. Why is it? Do you think that's a deliberate move to change the character of Dr. King and how he acted and what he accomplished? Or is it simply because with the patina of time, that we begin to idolize, we idolize the founding fathers of the country, and they were imperfect human beings, and some of them were radicals. Is it because of that, or is it deliberate?
Well, I don't know whether it was deliberate, but it really doesn't matter, because that's what exists. I think that there are some other deliberate mischaracterizations of King when people talk about that he had this dream of a colorblind society. He never expressed that. And so there's some definite intentional distortions there that are going on today. But it's not just now. It's not just 50 years after his assassination. 20 years after his assassination, all of a sudden now we have nearly 80% approval rate in the country for King. And it's because his he was being misremembered as just as his daughter Bernice King said.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that perhaps might open some people's eyes and ears is a comment that you made that he was not a peacemaker. Explain that.
I heard Martin Luther King speak or preach 35 to 40 times. And I only once heard him advocate for peace, and that's when he came out against the war in Vietnam, and he was always pushing for peace in that realm. But rather than advocating for peace, he had a response to many authorities who would be saying quite often, Reverend King, when are we going to have some peace? When are you and the students going to let the country be peaceful? When are we going to move toward a peaceful society? And Martin Luther King would respond to that by saying, peace is not the absence of tension. Peace is the presence of justice. And until there is justice, there will be no peace. And this is what he said many times, often, because he was always asked this question. So I would say that it is really wrong to characterize him as a person who was principally concerned with peace in a generic sense.
But when you compare him to what was going on at the time, the riots later on, the riots about Vietnam, the Malcolm X and his approach to this, the Black Panthers, etc., he looks like a peacemaker. He practiced nonviolence. He didn't urge people to take up arms. He didn't urge people to burn things down. So when you compare him to the times and the tumult of the times, doesn't he come off as a peace, at least a figure of peace?
I don't think so. He comes off as a person who had a significantly different approach than many others, but I don't think it suggests peace, because there was nothing very peaceful around him when he was
right
in communities and so on. Yes, he differed from some of these other people in methods, but not in objectives.
Dr. Carter, I'm wondering about your thoughts on whether Dr. King was a man of peace. He preached love both in the pulpit and as part of the civil rights movement. He told followers to offer their oppressors forgiveness and understanding. Are those the words of a man of peace, or does that make him a radical?
Yeah, thank you for you know, inviting me to join into this conversation. I was very quiet because I was just learning so much and taking in the historical reflections of our other guests as well, and just, you know, basking in it. So again, I'm grateful to be here. I was actually making a few notes as our guest also was speaking, and this question about peace is one of the things I was reflecting on and making a couple notes about myself. I think this has something to do with how we think about Martin Luther King's religiosity. I think the question of religion is crucial here. The question of peace is also often attached to a certain way of understanding King's Christianity. And I think it's important to understand King as part of a tradition of people who, in their religiosity, whether it's expressed as Christianity, whether it's expressed in any other kind of religious tradition, often African Americans, Black folk in the New World, in North America, when they take up these various religious postures, they bend them. They tweak them, and they twerk them, and they twist them, and they turn them in a different direction. And I think we have to understand the ways in which King was also doing just that. So that, you know, this question of peace is not just simply about everything being made placid, everything being made, you know, such that the real difficult issues aren't addressed. This is definitely not King. And even if you want to mobilize the word peace around him, it isn't the peace that we often talk about. Mm. It's more in accord, you know, King was a Baptist preacher. And so I can imagine King, you know, going to the gospel text of the New Testament and thinking with Jesus, I came not to bring peace but a sword. I've come to set at odds mother against father, father against mother. And what that would mean in the U.S. context, a context of, to use a word that often we don't like to say out loud, but I think it's quite fitting and appropriate, in a context of American white supremacist racism, mm-hmm. the kind of struggle for a different kind of society that King was interested in would set various citizens against one another. And the point isn't to stir up a pot and to just have people at odds with each other. The point is to raise the question, well, what does peace even look like? What would justice even look like? Rather than just sort of living into a kind of common sense of what we think peace is and what we think righteousness is, that question needs to be, in some sense, shaken up, unearthed, and put frontally in front of us. And that's what King, in many ways, was about.
Well, Jesus was a radical in his time, and we tend to forget that. We see him as a peacemaker and a man.
Absolutely.
So is it unnatural for people to put this warm glow of positiveness on people who, at their time, were shaking the status quo?
I think this is what has happened with regard to King. And I think it's also something that has happened with regard to Jesus. If I can just go ahead and be direct about it, we just came out of the Easter weekend festivities in the Christian tradition. Mm-hmm. And there's a way in which, you know, Easter becomes this, you know, really sanitized moment. It was a quite radical event.
Yes, it was. Let's take a break. We're going to come back with Dr. J. Cameron Carter from the Duke Divinity School and Warney Reed with the Race and Social Policy Center at Virginia Tech. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Dr. Warney Reed, Director of the Race and Social Policy Center at Virginia Tech, and Dr. J. Cameron Carter, who is Associate Professor of Theology, English, and African American Studies at the Duke Divinity School. And we're meeting together here today on the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King in Memphis, Tennessee. I want to get back to this religious nature of Dr. King, because he was a formidable speaker, and a lot of that came from the fact that he had great skills in the pulpit, and his skills in the pulpit transferred to the public sphere, and as did his Christian fundamentals, I would say, that must have informed him through and through. And you said, Dr. Carter, and I'm paraphrasing here, that the tradition of the Black Church in America was to affirm the dignity of its congregants, who had very little dignity outside the walls of that church. Talk about that.
Yes, to affirm the dignity of his congregants. I mean, as I was saying before we went to break, I mean, I think we need to understand and think about King's religiosity in a very different way than we tend to think about religiosity, in a very kind of watered-down way. I'll say it this way. What has tended to happen in the modern world, what has tended to happen in the context of North America and the United States of America, is that religion has done the work of moving in relationship to the state and its interests. So giving, therefore, the state and its interests a certain kind of holiness and righteousness, a sense of self-evidence and common sense, so that a sense of white superiority over black inferiority then acquires, through the way in which religion comes along to back it, it acquires the sense of righteousness and self-evidence. King's religiosity moved against that. And in a certain sense, it was cutting the Gordian link between the statecraft, right, and the race logics of statecraft, and the ways in which that statecraft worked religiously. He was cutting that, and that's what made his religiosity, in some sense, on one level, people heard words like peace, and they thought they understood what it meant, but actually when you looked at it in practice, it was exploding the order of things. This is a part of the black rhetorical tradition as well, and the ways in which that rhetoric was a moving in relationship to a broad canvas of human dignity that, again, moved against the interest of the state. And that's why this moment of King celebrating, thinking about King's assassination and what it means, is an occasion and an opportunity to revisit these questions.
Would it be fair to say, Dr. Reed, that Dr. King and his message of dignity for black people in America, he was such a powerful speaker, and he got such a great deal of attention in the press, and he was one of the leading figures of the 1960s, that he put that message across so many times and in such a public forum and such large forums that white America couldn't ignore it anymore? They had to acknowledge it.
Well, yes, but they could have had he not carried on some activism behind it, because many other people had been preaching about this, and I use preaching in the broader sense there, in the pulpit and in other places, and many of them being quite eloquent. Not necessarily better than Martin Luther King, but what some of them did not do is move to that next step and move into the streets and to demonstrate it, to bring it even closer to the eyeballs of the American public.
I think it bears mentioning here that since you lived through the civil rights movement, that America, although there's much to do, and many people will argue that not much has been accomplished, the America of 1968 was very different from the America of today in most people's eyes. Does it bear, I mean, even though he didn't accomplish everything he wanted to accomplish, should we put it into the context of how much road had to be traveled?
Well, I guess both. A lot of road had to be traveled, but a lot of road was still left. And I just want to make a more general, maybe indirect comment in response to your question there. And that is the assumption that some basic things are better. I would argue that the three things he was working on, what he called the three evils of society, the evil of poverty, the evil of racism, and the evil of war, I would say that we have had no improvement on either of those. In fact, in some instances, it has gotten worse. For example, on poverty, he said that he was willing to give his life for the effort to force the country to attend to its poor people. and to do it forthrightly. At that time, the proportion of children in the country who were in poverty was around 15-16%. Today, it's nearly 20%. It is a lot worse. And so we go around saying that it's better, and people begin to believe that it's better, but it's not.
Right. Well, may I jump
on
in?
War.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes, go ahead.
No, I thought you were at a pause. I don't want to cut you off. Please finish your thought.
No, well, I wanted to mention the next two, which are the evil of war. And since his death, we had probably a worse situation in by invading Iraq and so on. So we have continuing wars. We spending so much on military. In fact, the U.S. spends more on its military than the next eight countries combined. He would be pushing against that. So I would say that in the issue of war, we have gotten, if any better, not much better. Now let me move to racism. I think we have gotten worse, and I could demonstrate it.
Has it gotten worse, or has it reared its ugly head? Do people feel emboldened to bring their racism out into the open that perhaps they have suppressed since his assassination?
When I speak of racism, I'm talking about racial discrimination acts to the detriment of, in a specific instance, African Americans. So it has less to do with what's inside a person and whether or not it comes out or not. It has to do with what they do.
Okay.
So when I talk about racism, I'm only talking about that, not what somebody thinks, feels, and how they believe. I think that's, relatively speaking, unimportant. It's what they do. And so we have this serious mass incarceration with the disproportionate prosecution of African Americans in the criminal justice system. The criminal justice system is worse now toward African Americans in the issue of race than when Martin Luther King was killed.
Yes,
so we're on the basic issues that he was working on, night and day, we are no better and probably altogether worse.
Dr. Carter.
Yes, thank you. I just want to really underscore what Dr. Reed is saying here. This is crucial. We must remember that what got King killed ultimately, what put the target on his back ultimately, is after he gives that sermon slash speech at the Riverside Church in New York City, and he names these three issues around poverty, militarism, and racism. It was at this moment when he connected the struggles that he had been about all those years to an international and global structure. It was at that point, and became explicit about the United States' complicity in these global, not just local, global as global evils. It was at that point that within 1 year he was assassinated. These three issues, poverty, militarism, racism, as Dr. Reed is pointing to, these are structural matters. These will go to the heart of how the United States is structured as a polity. And in effect, what King was starting to do was call for a revolution in the structure. You might say that before 1968, King was calling for the reformation. I'll use a religious language, the reformation of the United States. 1968, when he gives this Riverside speech, he's not calling for reformation anymore. He's calling for a revolution of the United States. He's looking for he's not even anti American. He's more radical. He's calling for something like an ante America. We need a new vision of what America could be that we've never even seen before. It's at that moment that a target is on his back, and he locates the three pivots of the structure, the racism, the militarism, and the poverty. On this racism thing, Michael Brown being shot in the middle of the street, Freddie Gray being thrown around in the back of a police van, Sandra Bland being thrown down to the ground, and we can go on and on and on. These are not just manifestations of police with bad intentions. This is a kind of police structure that we're dealing with. And when King talks about racism, he's talking about that structure. You know, it's not enough to have a few people included, because the inclusion of a few upwardly mobile black folk is always at the exclusion of those who get read as less than citizen, improperly American, because they walk with their pants down a little bit, et cetera, et cetera. King is pointing to that. And at that point, the king who's making the Riverside speech in just before he's assassinated in 68, and the Malcolm X, they're walking down the same street together. There's not much daylight between King and Malcolm at that point. And that's not the king who gets memorialized in D.C.
So we spoke at the very beginning of the program about this.
Can I add something to what Dr. Carter has just said? I just want to underscore something that he said, and it was implicit in his statement. But at the time that Martin Luther King, after he came out against the war, he became the international leader against Americans' position in Vietnam, the international leader, and that made the target that Dr. Carter's talking about even larger.
So at the very beginning of the program, we mentioned this Gallup poll that came out 2 years prior to his assassination that showed that there was widespread disapproval of King. Mm-hmm. Was that mostly from white folks, or did that extend to the black community as well because of the speed at which the movement was taking and his approach to it in general? How would you characterize the disapproval from whom it came?
It was mostly from whites. Whites were, the majority of whites were, the overwhelming majority of whites were against King. And the majority of blacks were for King, but a very large proportion of blacks were against him and had been all along. Most of the blacks against him had been against him from the beginning. In fact, Martin Luther King was not that popular among many middle-class black Americans in the early 60s.
Why?
They began to get on board. Why? Mm-hmm. Oh, they didn't think it was appropriate to do such things as demonstrate in the street and follow these students, these SNCC workers and all of those around and do those kinds of things.
How did they view his turn-the-other-cheek approach versus Malcolm X more-in-your-face approach?
Well, his turn-the-other-cheek did not mean that he was going to stop pushing for desegregation of this society. His turn-the-other-cheek has been interpreted to mean that, well, we're going to be here, and regardless of what you do to us, we are going to be docile and turn the other cheek. I think that, as Dr. Carter has said, that's a perverse way of looking at his religiosity. Mm-hmm. And so that was his turning the other cheek has been mischaracterized a lot since his death. Before his death, there was not much discussion about that. The discussion was about the other. And for example, I can give an example of how Martin Luther King was not that well-loved in the early 60s in the African-American community. Often in his church in Ebenezer, when Martin Luther King was a co-pastor with his father, Dr. King Jr. would preach the sermon, and his father, Daddy King, would get up and say, "Well, sisters and brothers, I'm afraid we've heard another mighty sermon." And then he would say something very significant. He said, "I'm not going to be like these other ministers." He meant these middle and upper middle class ministers like himself. "I'm not going to be like them. I'm going to follow these young men." So many of the churches, and the church leaders especially, were not on board with King and the movement. Yeah. We began to get on board as we began to have some successes with the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 1965 Voting Rights Act.
Dr. Carter. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just wanted to again follow on the heels of the beautiful comments of Dr. Reed. My way of sort of maybe saying something similar to what Dr. Reed is saying is this, is that from the 60s all the way up to the present, there's always been, inside of black social life itself, a contestation over the meaning of people like King and others like him. And I name that contestation respectability. What does respectability mean? The kind of respectability politics. What does a dignified blackness look like? And a dignified blackness is always in relationship to something that's deemed undignified. And so part of what King was, I think, negotiating and dealing with, and part of what he stoked in people, was the ways in which they got invested in American respectability. And the problem with that is that American respectability is part of the structural logic of American racism. And so when he's pushing against respectability, part of what's being pushed against for white folk and for black folk are our complicit investments, our shared investments and affective attachments to what it means to be a proper American. But always the logic of proper Americanness always has an excluded other on the other side of it. Mm-hmm. And that's part of what King is dealing with. And it actually goes to as well how we have received King. Part of what's at stake in this 50th anniversary of King's, the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., is this. The post-civil rights, which started in the 1980s, and now the post-racial, the 2000s, the post-civil rights, post-racial reception of Martin Luther King. What we're calling whitewashing of King might be more precisely called the post-civil rights reception of King and then the post-racial reception of King, in which the edges of what King was calling for, the kind of deep structural critique that King was advancing around Americanism, gets shaved down, you know, sanded down. And then we get a King, in effect, that becomes the one who becomes the phantasm of our own post-racial blues. Mm.
Jesse Jackson, writing this morning in the New York Times, says America loathes marchers but loves martyrs. And the bullet in Memphis made Dr. King a martyr for the ages. And he too refers to Dr. King as a radical, and he knew him well. I only have a minute in this segment, but we don't tend to remember, because white liberals embraced the civil rights movement by and large, and certainly embraced Dr. King, but they were part of the problem, according to Dr. King. He himself said that liberal whites were the problem because they were on the fence. He said, at least with racists, you knew where they stood. So how much of the disapproval of Dr. King because of his comments on Vietnam and his Poor People's Campaign came from white liberals?
A lot, because many people just did not like that. You see, as Dr. Carter said earlier, Martin Luther King was pushing for a restructuring of the society, basically, and how it operated and how it dealt with its citizens. Well, many liberals think that the systems in the society are fine and perfect. They just have some imperfect parts. When people who are fighting like King and the rest of us, we know different. We know that the problem is the structure of the system.
Dr. Warney Reed is Director of Race and Social Policy Center at Virginia Tech. We will continue our conversation with him and Dr. J. Cameron Carter when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Dr. Martin Luther King today on the 50th anniversary of his assassination in Memphis, Tennessee, on this day in 1968. Dr. Warney Reed is with us. He's the director of Race and Social Policy Center at Virginia Tech, where he is this morning. And Dr. J. Cameron Carter is an associate professor of theology and English and African American studies at the Duke Divinity School. He joins us from the studios of WUNC in Durham. We've been talking a lot about Dr. King and misconceptions about Dr. King and how his image or his character has been burnished over the years for various different reasons. But at the time, it could easily be said, I don't think there's any argument in this, that he was, if not the, he's at the top of the pyramid of civil rights activists of his time. How did that happen? How did he emerge and not others? Because there were others.
I'll jump in first, and okay. then I would love to hear Dr. Reed's reflections on this as being, you know, historically closer to it than I was. But in some sense, I want to begin to lean back on that question a little bit, push back on it a little bit. I think it's important, even as we sort of celebrate and recognize the stature of King to the movement, I think it's equally important that we not monumentalize King. I think he's undergone a severe monumentalization. If America likes martyrs, it also likes monuments, too. And we're inside of a struggle over monuments now. You know, do these monuments of Robert E. Lee or this monument or that monument come down? We love our monuments, too, because monuments do something for us. And one of the things I think monuments do is they occlude the fact that it was actually a social movement. King, in some sense, I like to think along the model of a jazz musician, you know, John Coltrane. Coltrane was amazing. Everybody will concede, you know, who has any kind of inkling of knowledge about the history of music and jazz in particular. Coltrane was amazing. But Coltrane was Coltrane because an ensemble commissioned him to be Coltrane. Without the without the ensemble, there's a sense in which Coltrane is unintelligible. Hmm. Coltrane is an avatar of something that is bigger than Coltrane and that commissioned Coltrane, and to which Coltrane was accountable. Similarly, King was an avatar of something that was way bigger than him. And part of what happens also when we monumentalize, the monuments tend to become masculine. And so what happens is we tend to lose the groundswell of women in relationship to whom, you know, this movement in many ways would be unthinkable. And so I actually want to shrink King down a little bit in order to, like, you know, blow up and blow out the social conditions that make him possible. And the sociality that makes King possible is what we need to think about. And that's what things like, for me, Black Lives Matter as a movement and the various social protest movements are about. King is a signifier of a movement, not a monument.
Your thoughts to Dr. Reed?
Yeah, I agree. And I really like Dr. Carter's characterization of that issue of where King stands at the top of this heap. There's also some misunderstandings and misremembrances of what King actually did in a more general way. First of all, Martin Luther King was chosen by the leaders in Montgomery to be their spokesperson because he was this young, bright, fantastic, new person to town. As E.D. Nixon, who was the black leader of Montgomery during the time, said that we chose King because he had not been here long enough to have made many enemies, and he had not been here long enough to have been bought off by the establishment, which happened all too often and is why many, many movements fail. But beyond that, and so the bus boycott was called by Joanne Robinson, as Dr. Carter said, a woman, independent of even E.D. Nixon. And so then E.D. Nixon and the group organized to form this Montgomery Improvement Association and appoint King as the spokesperson, and King in his oratory and brilliant eloquence and his commitment to the struggle kind of meant that he became an effective leader. But what people think is that Martin Luther King traveled around the country and stirred up African Americans and whites to protest against things. Well, he did, but he was invited to these places because all around the country there were these civil rights activities, and they would bring King in because King had more notoriety. He was better known, and he would raise the ante, and he would make it more public, the local issues, like he was doing in the Memphis garbage worker strike. So this is what he did, and yes, he became the leader, but he was not the person who decided what was going to happen in each community and so on. We had all of these ensembles, as Dr. Carter would call it, producing King and others. There were many other heroic figures. Just King just kind of stood out more than others. But in the sense that we honor King, we tend to forget many of the others. And there are many who were carrying on the movement
and they were located all over the country in small towns and medium-sized cities and big cities as well. Charlotte seemed to navigate the tricky waters churned up by the civil rights movement more easily than some other cities, and that includes what happened in cities across this country in the days following Dr. King's assassination. 100 cases of civil unrest occurred, and riots broke out in Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Chicago, Louisville, New York City. Some areas in Washington were scarred for decades, but not here. And there's reason for that. And Dan Morrill is here to share his thoughts on how this city's approach to race relations may have spared us. An historian, he's a consulting director of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Historic Landmarks Commission. Dr. Morrill, welcome back to the program.
Good to talk to you.
Following Dr. King's assassination, there were riots, as I said, around the country. Raleigh saw the worst riots in its history. The governor at the time dispatched the National Guard to Raleigh, to Greensboro, to Wilmington, to Wilson, to Durham, to Goldsboro. Charlotte is conspicuously absent from that list. Why?
Because the business, corporate, institutional leadership of Charlotte was so traumatized by what had already happened here that they were absolutely dedicated to an accommodationist program. Mayor Brookshire mayor from 61 to 69, patterned his leadership after Ivan Allen Jr., the mayor of Atlanta, and they were going to keep things quiet. It was really the events of earlier years that had really shocked Charlotte's leadership.
Remind us of what they were. What were those? It's, give me a couple of examples.
September 4th, 1957, Dorothy Counts spat upon when she went into Harding High School all over the country. Gosh, that just shocked everybody. November 22nd, 1965, when four houses were bombed, Kelly Alexander's house and Fred Alexander's house and Reginald Hawkins' house and Julius Chambers' house literally had dynamite blow up. And this was so traumatizing to the leadership that they wanted to do what was necessary to keep the city calm.
Well, in an article that you wrote called Civil Rights Revolution in Mecklenburg County, you say that in the 1960s, and what you just said kind of underlines this, that Charlotte teetered on the edge of racial conflict. There were sit-in demonstrations at eight local lunch counters. You mentioned Dorothy Counts. You mentioned the bombings, etc. But is that all that did this for local leaders at the time on this day in 1968? Or didn't black leaders apply some pressure behind the scenes for changes to be made, or there would be some hot summers, to paraphrase one of the quotes there?
Oh, absolutely. The African-American, particularly ministers, particularly, and they sort of divided themselves into a more militant and moderate group. Coleman Carey, a name that practically nobody remembers, was more of the sort of moderate type of leadership. Certainly Fred Alexander, not a minister, but the first African-American elected to the Charlotte City Council of the 20th century. He was basically a moderate. But then you had firebrand. You had people like Reginald Hawkins. I mean, Hawkins was very, I mean, I could go on and on. I don't have time to do it, but he was very militant. I wouldn't say militant, insistent that change had to come. George Leak, again, many people have no idea who George Leak was, but he was a minister of Little Rock AME Zion Church. He was very outspoken about the belief that things had to change. And that was part of the dynamic.
Well, he was the person who talked about the long hot summers. He said Charlotte could experience some long hot summers and even chaos unless it curbed the racist behavior of some policemen at the time.
Well, there's no question about it. That's exactly what he said, and that was exactly his position.
On this day in 1968, as America discovered the assassination of Dr. King and riots began to break out in cities, I believe on this day in 1968, you attended a memorial service for Dr. King at St. Paul's Baptist Church. It was a black church in what was then the Brooklyn area of Charlotte, which was long ago bulldozed. It's where Marshall Park and the government district is now. Mayor Brookshire was there. Jim Martin, the chair of the county commission to the future governor of North Carolina, was there. How unusual was it for whites and blacks to come together like that at that time?
It was unbelievable. You know, I grew up in the age of segregation. I'm 80 years old. I was born in 1937. And people just don't realize how absolutely divided, separated our whole social system was. And to have George Leak really put out a statement. He said, you know, there was a memorial service at Ovens Auditorium on the 6th. And Leak said, you know, you white folks want us black folks always to come to your place. Why don't you come to our place? And that's really what caused this April 8th meeting to occur. Mm-hmm. And to have a mixed race audience in a black church in Charlotte in 1968 was absolutely astounding. I mean, now we wouldn't think that much about it, although we're still separated to a significant degree. It was an astounding event.
I want to get your thoughts for somebody who's been around for more than a minute or two And for somebody, and for somebody who has who was there on this night in 1968, when it was unusual for whites and blacks to commingle, every person today, every person in a key leadership role in Charlotte today, is African American. And some people would like to believe that's because we've tried to be racially inclusive, but this comes at the same time that our schools are more segregated than ever. What do you make of this dichotomy?
Well, the dichotomy is that, yes, we still don't live together. That's it. That's why the schools are segregated. We don't live together. We're still primarily residentially segregated. And that's why the schools are the way they are. And, of course, when busing ended and people largely go to schools that are the closest to their homes, they come out of the neighborhood. Mm. But at the same time, of course, you've got a leadership of the community politically that is responsive to the demographics of the electorate. So that's the dichotomy. We live together. I mean, we live separately. We work together. And we tend to, of course, vote for those that we believe respond to our interests.
Dan Morrill, historian, consulting director now of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Historic Landmarks Commission. Thank you for joining us for these few minutes. I appreciate it.
Always glad, Mike.
Dr. King made a speech in Memphis the night before his death. It was tinged with mortality. He told listeners that God had allowed him to go up to the mountain and look over and see the promised land. "I might not get there with you," he said, but he assured them that they would get there, because his eyes had seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. That refrain cropped up several times in speeches he made around the country, including here in North Carolina. 3 years earlier, during a speech in 1965 in Alabama, he talked about death then.
Deep down in our nonviolent creed is the conviction that there are some things so dear, some things so precious, something so eternally true that they're worth dying for. And if a man happens to be 36 years old, as I happen to be, and some great truth stands before the door of his life, some great opportunity to stand up for that which is right and that which is just, and he refuses to stand up because he wants to live a little longer, and he's afraid his home will get bombed, or he's afraid that he will lose his job, or he's afraid that he will get shot or beat down by state troopers. He may go on and live until he's 80, but he's just as dead as 36 as he would be at 80, and the cessation of breathing in his life is merely the belated announcement of an earlier death of the spirit.
In his writing, in his column today in the New York Times, Jesse Jackson says, and he was speaking about the speech that he made the night before in Memphis, that none of us took those words as a premonition. Do you think they were? Did you think he was preoccupied with death, or was he just a realist, that he was putting himself out there at a time when he was advocating radical social change? Dr. Carter.
Yeah, I was just listening to those words there. Oh, my God, they're riveting. They're just riveting. I mean, I was just trying to write a couple notes on just listening to them.
I have 20 seconds.
Yeah, okay, so let me just at least attempt to say something. I mean, I think on one level what King is pointing to is the fact that to be black in America is always already to be, in some sense, living under a certain kind of death sentence.
Yeah.
And you're already mourning, right, a kind of wake that's coming.
As I mentioned at the beginning, before we even started this program, this could go for at least 2 hours, and I have to stop it here, and I'm very sorry for that. Dr. Cameron Carter with Duke Divinity School and Dr. Warney Reed, Director of the Race and Social Policy Center at Virginia Tech. Thank you both for the hour.